Hi, everyone. It's Tom Power. I'm back with a brand new and very special episode of Toy Heart, my podcast about bluegrass. It is an exclusive conversation with none other than Billy Strings that we recorded at last year's International Bluegrass Music Association Conference. If you love bluegrass as much as we do, and I assume you do, then this episode is certainly for you. Download and listen to this and all episodes of Toy Heart on the BGS Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to The Working Songwriter, the show where today's best songwriters come to talk shop. I'm your host, Joe Pug. Each episode here, we host a distinguished guest, and we ask them to go deep on their inspiration, on their process, on the general ups and downs of making a life in music. So, whether you're a grizzled veteran in litigation against Suno for illegally sampling your catalog, or else a scrappy upstart sampling the hum of a recently built data center behind your house, this is your show, because ultimately, it is what every writer seeks most, an ironclad excuse to put off actually writing. This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. I'm old enough to remember when you had to pay somebody called a web developer to get a website made. It would always be some guy named Mainframe, who drove an Acura from 1993 with a mint condition spoiler, and who was always trying to sell you terabytes of social security numbers that he pirated from the dark web. An old Mainframe would charge you about $1,000 for a website that would be obsolete in 6 months. But it's the future now, you guys. That's not how it works anymore. We're allowed to have nice things now. One of those nice things is Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. Everything you need is already built in. Music players, images, text bio, video embeds, a gig calendar, and press quotes. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and the Working Songwriter podcast listeners can go to bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. Then use the promo code TWSEPK to get 10% off the first year of any new EPK plan subscription. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, if you'd like to help it remain a viable endeavor for me, here's a couple things that you could do to help. First, you could become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private members-only section of my website that hosts every single episode of The Working Songwriter ever recorded. Additionally, The Vault has every single album I've ever recorded for streaming and for download. There's also an archive of all of the Enthusiast Digest newsletters there. Go to joepugmusic.com/vault. Become a subscriber today. It's about the price of a nice cup of coffee every month. Okay, I'll end all the harassment there. I hope that you enjoy this week's episode. Our guest this week is one of the godfathers of modern roots and Americana music. Originally from Toledo, Ohio, Gary Lewis moved to Minneapolis as a young man in the 1970s and immersed himself in a Twin Cities music scene that punched way above its weight culturally. His group, the Jayhawks, would release a string of critically acclaimed and nationally beloved albums. One of Lewis's main gifts is his ability to contribute to the music of a wide array of other artists. He's contributed to the recordings of Counting Crows, John Hiatt, Lucinda Williams, Roger McGuinn, The Wallflowers, The Black Crows, Nickel Creek, and a host of others. As a member of the Jayhawks, he's appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman and Conan. He's recorded for what sounds like an anthology of record labels: Twin Tone, American Recordings, Ryko Disc, Lost Highway, 30 Tigers, Rounder, Sony, and New West Records. Over the years, he's appeared at Farm Aid, Stagecoach, Hardly Strictly Bluegrass, and Wilco's Sky Blue Sky Festival. All Music calls him one of the premier songwriters of his generation. The Bluegrass Situation, our host network, has written about him as a musical Swiss Army knife. Pitchfork has written that he and his musical partner in the Jayhawks, Mark Olson, sang like they were born joined at the throat. It's an immense honor to have him on the show today. I got a chance to catch up with him a few weeks ago to hear about his musical journey so far.
Mr. Gary Louris, what an honor to have you on the Working Songwriter podcast. When we started this show 10 years ago, it was for someone like you that we had in mind. You're such a legend, and we thank you so much.
Hear that, honey? I'm a legend. See?
Yes.
She knows that. I tell her every day.
He Venmo'd me $50 to say that at the start. Yeah. So right here. So
that's just where that money went.
Yeah. I followed your music for so many years. I did not know until getting ready for this interview, though, that you're originally from Toledo, Ohio. What did music look like for you in your household and around Toledo growing up?
Yeah, I was born in Toledo and lived there until I moved to go to college to University of Minnesota. So my first 17 years were spent in the Mideast. Musically, you know, it's kind of a miracle that I'm a musician because my dad had a tin ear. I don't remember him ever listening to music. My sister, you know, who's 5 years older, love her, but she wasn't like a rock person. Never has been, never will be. She loved things like Cole Porter, Irving Berlin. You know, I love that stuff too. But, you know, in our record collection at home, we have the old hi-fi, and it would be like Franti and Teicher, which were two pianists. There was the Singing Nun album. There was a lot of kind of stereo testing records, like, I don't know why, and just you know, funny, some soundtracks for the Music Man and things like that. But my sister had three records that would be considered somewhat rock. One was, or was it two? Yeah, three. She had Sgt. Pepper's, and she had Chad and Jeremy of Cabbages and Kings, and she had The Stones' Flowers. And that was the only thing that was anywhere near rock and roll growing up. However, my mother was a lover of music and insisted Priscilla, my sister, and I took piano lessons. So from age 6 to 14, I took piano lessons. My mother loved her Andy Williams, Andy Baby, as she'd call him. And, you know, crooner, Sinatra, Perry Como, but she also really loved Ella Fitzgerald. So my mother had the musical ear, but I don't remember any of them ever really putting an album on. I was just listening to the radio. And so, but at age 14, but I was captivated by music right away. And I listened to a radio station called CKLW, the Motor City, which was out of Detroit, Windsor. And that's where I got my music from, because it was the 60s, so, and it was Detroit. So there's a lot of Motown, some soul music. There was a lot of Beatles, Stones, Kinks. I remember vividly listening to the Stones and the Beatles and the Kinks. And for some reason, Bill Withers on CKLW, the Motor City. And then at age 14, my mother, knowing I was an introverted, shy kid, thought, maybe I should learn how to play guitar, because in her mind, it was a folk world where I would go to parties and play folk songs and I'd become really popular. So it actually kind of panned out, because look at me now, I'm a legend. Yeah. And I had my wife I above my pay grade.
So when did you realize music was going to be something more than just you know, kind of an infatuation? Lots of people are into music and dig it when they're young, and they don't go on to end up doing it for a living. It's a very strange living to make. You would even go to school for architecture, and so it seems like music wasn't like the original plan for you. When did it start to look like it would be something different for you?
Not until I was like 26 or so, really late. I'm very much a late bloomer. And I was too shy to be in a band. I didn't play with anybody in Toledo except maybe my neighbor across the street a little bit, who was obsessed with the band Yes. And, you know, he had a Les Paul. Or my first band I was in, which wasn't really a band, a little Christian trio at church, and a guy named Frank was in my class. He had an SG, and I played a classical guitar, but thought that was cool. You know, I don't know. Music came really easily to me as opposed to everything else in life, which sometimes can be hard. It just seemed like, well, I can learn these songs easily. I love music, but it was always kind of on the back burner. I fairly practical. I thought, well, I want to, maybe someday I could do it. I know that's what I'd like to do, but I don't see a clear path. So I'm going to go to school. I know I'm good at math and drawing, and I love architecture. So I went to school in architecture, but always with the, you know, in the back of my mind, playing music. So when I was in college at the University of Minnesota, I ran into some guys in the elevator carrying some albums, and we became friends and found out that they were in a British rock cover band. And I joined that, and it was all for fun. You know, we played like three shows, real legitimate shows. It was more like a hobby for them, but it was my first taste of being in a band. And then from there, it started to be, you know, then I got into songwriting, but it really was only in my early 20s that I did that. I didn't have an electric guitar until I was probably 18 or so. So not in a band till I was 26 or so. And, you know, not in the Jayhawks till I was 30. So, you know, I still continued to work as an architect, especially in historic restoration. But as I joined a band called Safety Last, which was a rockabilly band in Minneapolis, I started going back between working as an architect and also maybe I was waitering. Waiting tables was a way to kind of tour a little bit more, have flexibility. It's a long answer. But 1991, there were the crossroads of I was offered a scholarship to go to the Columbia University to study historic restoration, get my graduate degree. Mm-hmm. We were also offered a record contract with Deaf American and Rick Rubin. And that was kind of like, I followed my heart, you know, and for better or for worse, most days I think I made the right choice. But that's the story, I guess. Long-winded as it is.
You know, I think, well, long-winded is what podcasts are for. That is the format that we're in. That's what we're after here.
So yeah, I want to do my own podcast. I want in.
There's nothing to it.
I want my wife to have one because she's the funniest person I know.
There's nothing to it, and it would be a great one. I think any time that someone moved to Minneapolis could be an auspicious time to move there musically, because there's always just such great music coming out of Minneapolis. It's such an underrated, under-the-radar, wonderful music town. But it was particularly auspicious when you moved there in the 80s. It seems like there was a lot of different music coming out of there that would become very influential. Can you kind of speak to that, what you were seeing on the ground? I'm sure there were several different scenes of music coming out of there. What do you remember the most in that sense, culturally?
Yeah, I mean, when I moved there in the 70s to go to school, I wasn't in the band at first, but I went to a lot of shows. There was a great club called the Longhorn, where I'd see local bands, but I got to see the Boomtown Rats and the Buzzcocks and the Stranglers and met the Clash, who were at a Buzzcock show in a little club. And because I was a big English punk rock fan, so before I ever knew what a banjo was, I was all about Brit pop and British rock and punk rock and art rock. Really what I cut my teeth on. So there was a great club, and I'd go see some bands. There was a band called the Suicide Commandos, who were kind of a little before when the scene got really known in the 80s, the late Steve Almas, thinking of him. But then, you know, by the early 80s, there was definitely, it seemed like everybody was in a band, you know, and there was definitely a scene. There was the rock scene, and there's a lot of rock music. There was kind of a folk scene, roots, bluegrass kind of scene. That was in an area called the West Bank in Minneapolis, which is on the other side of the river, part of the University of Minnesota. And that we were the first band to kind of bridge between the rock scene and the folk scene. We went over to the West Bank, and we were kind of rebellious. We were kind of crossing into sacred territory. But at the time, everybody's in a band, especially by the mid-80s when we became a band. Oh my God, everybody was in a band. Of course, there were the Replacements and Husker Du and Soul Asylum and Babes in Toyland and us and a million other bands, and a lot of them that were really cool that people may never know. Run Westy Run was like the cool Stooges, mm-hmm. Dora Stooges band that Craig Johnson came out of, who played with us and plays in the Golden Smog. And then there was also Prince and the Time and all that all going at the same time. So it was kind of like a lucky break that I ended up moving to a place. I moved to Minneapolis because it was a big, I had gone to 12 years of Catholic school, all male school. And I was going to go to Notre Dame, and I pulled the plug on that last minute. I said, I want to go to a big school and architecture. And my sister lived there and her husband. So I just happened to stumble upon the right place at the right time in the 80s.
When you were in the middle of that, I mean, you just named a murderer's row of other bands in your cohort there. At the time, did you realize something special was going on, or was it only in retrospect you could look back and be like, man, that was a great group that we were a part of?
No, we knew. There was a cover story in Newsweek about the Minneapolis scene in 85 or 86. It was pretty, yeah, there was something in the air, you know. And it also had a great club, which was called First Avenue, 7th Street Entry. It had all the elements that create a scene. You know, like you say, why were there so many great bands from Minneapolis, but maybe not that many from Pittsburgh or another, I mean, I love Pittsburgh, but. And a lot of it is just, I had a cool little record company called Twin Tone. And it had some cool radio stations. It had cool clubs and a cool record store called Orfolk Joke Opus, which was where, you know, the Replacements would hang out. And it's like a clubhouse, and you'd go there to get all the cool records. So all those things contributed to creating a scene, and everybody knew each other, you know.
That is wild. You know, I've heard you talk so far about, you know, the British rock that influenced you and all that, but you are very identified now as one of the people that brought kind of roots and Americana music to the forefront. There wasn't really a word for it when you began doing it in, you know, the mid-80s. When did what we would now call roots music, when did that start to enter your musical lexicon?
It is ironic that I've become known as this roots Americana godfather in a way, but I really grew up, and still my sweet spot is British music, whether it's the Jam, the Clash, or it's the Kinks and the Stones, or all those pretty things, and Zombies, and I love anything and everything British. I mean, at our house, BBC is always on, whether on TV or radio. We kind of almost make it feel like we're living in England. So, you know, if we could, we'd probably live in England. But I found when I was playing with that British rock cover band, Schnauzer was the name of the band. We intentionally picked the weirdest, stupidest name we could, because we weren't really very serious about being a household name, but my friend Jay, who was the lead singer, came down one day. I can vividly see, because we practiced in his parents' basement. and came down the stairs with this record in his hand, shaking, goes, "You got to hear this." And I'll never forget that visual. And it was Elvis Sun Sessions. Hmm. And I became obsessed with Elvis and that record. And that record was kind of the gateway to me learning about classic country and Western swing and Fats Waller and Bill Monroe, and got into soul music and Al Green and James Carr and all those beautiful genres and bluegrass and country. I already said that, blues and folk, all these things that I hadn't really listened to. I hadn't really been a Dylan fan up to that point, or a Neil Young fan. I was all Brit all the time. So that kind of came later for me. So that's why I feel like the foundation of my songwriting and of a lot of Jayhawks music is almost British pop rock music, as far as, but then it has, I added mixed into it or on top of it is all this, what I found was the soulful element that sometimes was missing from pop music, from soul, and you know, the deeper stacks and storytelling. So kind of all mixed together, but it started with British, and then in my 20s I kind of discovered American music. And you know, for me it was good because I was never going to be able to I loved Joe Strummer and the Clash, but I was never going to be that guy on stage. I could never
right.
But I could identify with singing with an American accent and softer, deeper kind of music. Well, not deeper, but...
Yeah. You mentioned, in your own words, kind of coming late to being in a band, kind of a late bloomer there, you know, 26, late 20s. That must also mean that you came late to a certain degree to songwriting. What was it like beginning to compose your own stuff? Were you, did you take to it like a duck to water immediately, or were there things you had to learn to get up to speed?
No, it came pretty quickly. I remember when I first started recording myself, I had like a Philips reel-to-reel in Minneapolis in the late 70s. And I heard my voice recorded the first time, and I liked it. I liked my voice, and I was like, I had a roommate named the late John Oliver, who was not really a musician, but he was creative and smart guy. And he was my roommate for a while. We started writing some songs together because he knew this band called Safety Last, and they were looking for some songs. So he and I dabbled, and it, you know, and then I kind of splintered off on my own. As John only wrote a few songs, but it seemed it came to me pretty naturally, and I didn't do a lot of studying of it. I don't have a composition degree or anything, but it you know, just from listening, and you know, my first songs were very much copying other people's songs and changing them, you know, like you do to learn how to write.
When you first began, was it a very intense period where you just composed and composed and composed a bunch, or did it slowly ramp up over time?
I think it was once I got the bug and I had my little recording studio, pretty humble, wasn't Pro Tools. I was bouncing tracks, you know, so to make like the Beatles used to when you only had four tracks, bounce them down to one track, freeing three tracks so you could make more room. And of course, when, and I just posted an old song of mine. I have some of them. In fact, along with my Bandcamp, I will give a plug while I'm thinking of it. I have a
please song do. Called
Patreon.com/GaryLouris. And that's where I share some archival things, new things, songs I'm working on, old photos, what I'm doing. And yeah, so Patreon, patreon.com/GaryLouris. But like I just posted something, one of my old songs, along with our new song, American Midnight. I did a version of that, which came out today. I think is going to be available on streaming services. So Yeah, I have a collection of these things, and they're really lo-fi, but they're, you know, like, and really sloppy, because I wasn't playing to a click, and it has a certain charm, even though it's really not, doesn't really sound like Jayhawk songs. They're definitely more power pop kind of songs.
Though he's originally from Toledo and has made his home in Canada for many years, I think it's fair to consider Gary's music a cultural export of the Twin Cities, at least in part. And one of my favorite poets was, for a time, the poet laureate of Minnesota, Robert Bly. His poems can be dark and detailed and evocative, not unlike many of Gary's and the Jayhawks' songs. A work of his that epitomizes that tone is entitled Awakening. We are approaching sleep. The chestnut blossoms in the mind mingle with thoughts of pain. And the long roots of barley, bitterness as of the oak roots staining the waters dark in Louisiana. The wet streets soaked with rain and sodden blossoms. Out of this we have come, a tunnel softly hurtling into darkness. The storm is coming. The small farmhouse in Minnesota is hardly strong enough for the wind. Darkness, darkness in grass, darkness in trees. Even the water in wells trembles. Bodies give off darkness, and chrysanthemums are dark, and horses who are bearing great loads of hay to the deep barns where the dark air is moving from corners. Lincoln's statue and the traffic. From the long past into the long present, a bird, forgotten in these troubles, warbling, as the great wheel turns around, grinding the living in water. Washing, continual washing, in water now stained with blossoms and rotting logs. Cries, half muffled, from beneath the earth, the living awakened, at last like the dead.
Take me to that moment that you referenced earlier, that crossroads, as you described it, either graduate school or take a record deal. What did it feel like for you? You know, it's 1991. I think George Draculius heard you guys and offers you this deal, a major label deal. What did that ride feel like when you make the decision to not go to graduate school and step on the show business train? What did that feel like?
I feel, as I remember it, feeling pretty confident about the choice I made. Now, you know, when you're sitting in the back of a van one day and you start to think, what if? But I never would have met my wife. I wouldn't have this life that I love. But I don't remember really having to wring my hands that much. I mean, I knew that music came more naturally to me than visually, as an architect. Architecture was something I could do, but I didn't feel like I was as gifted in that area as I was in music. So I followed my heart, and it was exciting because we had been a band for 6 years and felt like I could always go back to school somehow. If I really needed to, but how many times did you get a major label record deal?
Yeah. Well, and that's just it. You know, you guys, you were talking about that scene and how everyone knew each other, and you have Twin Tone there in the cities, but it's not Twin Tone that you're with. You're with this major label. Was there, talk a little bit about the difference between the work that you had done up to that point and then, you know, it sounds to me like you'd been playing AAA ball and you got called up to the big leagues. Was that a big difference at that point?
Huge difference. I mean, up until then, as much as I loved Twin Tone, it was, you could only go so far. We were actually almost broke up a couple times. And I was the only one who really had done some touring before the Jayhawks with Safety Last. And then as we toured Blue Earth, I was determined to not just get on the road and play a lot when you didn't have a record to promote. I remember that. So that was a really, you know, it was a funny time. Blue Earth was a record that was a bunch of demos that we made for other record companies, because we came onto the scene and pretty quickly we, in the 85, 86, we had an audience, and there was a bit of a buzz, and then there was a few record companies that were kind of sniffing around us, like IRS, mm-hmm. Atlantic, A&M, there were a few different ones, and before even Deaf American came along. But they always, you know, they couldn't quite get a handle on what our music was because it was different. It wasn't, there weren't a lot of bands doing what we were doing. It definitely didn't have a name to it. And so we'd always have somebody in the at the record company was a fan, but they were usually kind of an underling, and they'd be like, I got to talk to my boss. The labels would give us different money, and they said, well, we need to hear more, so can you do some demos? Eventually, nothing really happened. So Twin Tone agreed to put out Blue Earth, which was our demos, but we did overdubs on them. And, you know, we took them to another level, made it a record. And then nothing really happened. 87, 88, 89, 90, we kind of wandered the wilderness a bit, playing, but we all had jobs. Until, you know, George heard Blue Earth playing in the background as he was talking to Dave Ayers, who at the time was working at Twin Tone, but had known George because both George and Dave had worked at A&M together. So they stayed in touch. So, you know, kismet or whatever, George heard it over the phone and immediately was struck by it. I think he was looking for his version of the Birds. You know, they had Deaf American had their Stones with Black Crowes, and we were going to be like the Birds, I guess, or the Eagles, or whatever they thought we could be. And so he flew to Minneapolis and saw us play, and immediately we were pretty taken by him, because George is an incredibly charismatic and charming and funny and interesting character. And to have this guy come in after being kind of left in the desert, to all of a sudden have this guy who was was excited, and I'm going to take you to LA, we're going to make records, and, you know, it's pretty hard to resist.
I'll bet. Well, and it's even in the name of the record that would come out of that Hollywood Town Hall. I think part of it was at Pachyderm, which is where you would expect a Minneapolis band to record an album. But you guys went out to Los Angeles to do it. Can you kind of just speak to the heady nature of, you know, all of a sudden you're in Los Angeles recording a record?
It was a lot of pressure. I mean, I remember the local paper came out and they had somebody covering the story because it was kind of a big deal. And we did it all in Hollywood except for some overdubs and some B-sides that were done after the fact in Pachyderm and Cannon Falls. Also we drove our stuff out there.
Oh, wow.
Stayed and, you know, it was in a van. We stayed and we shared rooms. It was me and Olson and Perlman and Kenny Callahan. And it was terrifying, you know. It was like, this is our big chance. And so they put us in this studio that wasn't really, you know, it wasn't the fanciest studio. It's seen better days, but it was a great, at one time, pretty famous studio. It's called Hollywood Sound, but before that was called Wally Hyder 4, which is where they did some Bird stuff. They did Gram Parsons records.
Oh, nice.
And the big room was was where we did the basics. And then around the corner was the smaller room, which we did overdubs in. And, you know, we, it was tough because we were under the gun and our drummer, Kenny Callahan, got thrown under the bus a bit looking back because George was very particular about tempos and things like that. And, you know, whereas the rest of us could always overdub and fix things, you know, Kenny was the one who had to lay down the basics. And George, after a number of, I don't remember how long, we had to tell Kenny he wasn't playing on the record, which was really hard for us. It was hard for Kenny. And to this day, it's not our proudest moment, but at the time, we couldn't really say, screw you, George. You know, he was our A&R guy and our producer. And Kenny took it as like a gentleman and ended up, was vindicated because he ended up playing on some of the overdubs and B-sides and ended up playing on Joe Henry's next record, Short Man's Room, and did a great job. And Kenny's doing just fine. I stay in touch with him. So then we had to bring in audition drummers. And we brought in Bill Bateman from the Blasters. We brought in Jim Keltner, famous Jim Keltner audition. A guy named Thad Spencer, who was our old drummer back in Minneapolis, who was also had a music house in out in L.A., who had left the band to pursue his business. And Charlie Drayton is the guy who played. You know, there was Steve Jordan and Charlie Drayton. They both played in the Expensive Winos with Keith Richards. And they kind of switch off. Sometimes Charlie would play drums. And sometimes Steve would play drums and Charlie would play bass. Anyway, Charlie's a great drummer. And he came in and he was the winner. He was great. And he was sesh. And played great. And that was what, that's where George wanted to go. So, you know, we being polite Midwesterners who had not had a record deal and didn't, you know, we kind of followed what George said. And it was probably the best thing for the record. Charlie played great, but it was tough for us as a band. Like I said, Kenny was vindicated in the long run. He was a great drummer. And ended up continue playing with us. And so that worked out, but at the time it was tough. And then the rest of the record was, I would say what was interesting about it is that it sounds, we worked really hard to make it sound live, but it was mostly overdubbed. And no matter what we did, we were never going to sound super tight. We're just kind of, you know, that's part of the charm, I guess, but.
What were some of the things that you learned? What were some of the tools or maybe even tricks that you learned from working with George Draculius in the studio on that?
Well, I think to be able to take it. He was kind of brutal in a way, but in a funny way. It's hard to explain. Mm-hmm. George was, before I'd go to do a guitar take, it'd be very typical for George to say, don't embarrass me, or something, or, you know, things like that. Just kind of things that I found I used later in life when I was producing. It kind of would get me pissed, and I would get to go, well, I'm not going to be the guy that fucks up. And it kind of... that, and if you're going to have a solo, crank it up. You know, we blew a bunch of speakers in the control room when I'd be doing my fuzz solos because he'd like, let's get excited. Let's, a lot of people when they record, it's like, oh, you don't want to hurt your ears. You got to listen to it in a low level to, so you're really judging it correctly because when you turn it loud, everything sounds good. But George was like, crank it up. We're getting excited. And to this day, I learned, I thought that was a valuable lesson to learn.
Love that. I want to, before we get to your latest record here, I have one aspect of your career that I'm just personally very interested in because I love the band so much. I was hoping you could speak a little bit to your time working, producing the Sadies, who are just a band that I love so much. How did you meet those guys, and what was your working relationship with them like?
I'm glad you brought them up because they're one of my favorite people and bands. They just from touring, somehow they ended up on a bill with us, and then they toured with us and fell in love with them. I mean, they were everything you'd want in a band that I love. You know, like, they could play Pink Floyd, early Pink Floyd, kind of Piper's At the Gates of Dawn kind of stuff, and then they'd switch into Morricone spaghetti Western things and then into crazy psychedelic stuff, into the Birds stuff. And so I completely admired them, and we hit it off, and over time we stayed in touch. And when it came time to, they were making a record, they asked me to produce it. So I did. There were two records. I get a little mixed up which one happened first. One in Toronto and another one in Spain. But it was a tough one to work with them. I'll tell you why. A couple of reasons. I didn't want to mess with them. Yeah. They were like, they were showmen. They were so exciting and fun. But they wanted to work harder on their vocals. They wanted to be more serious about songwriting. And I didn't want to take away what's exciting about the Sadies, which is they were crazy fun. Yeah. But what they could get from me is maybe honing the harmonies, working on their vocals, and helping with the songwriting. And so it was a tightrope to walk a bit, to figure out how to keep what they do, and but also have them grow a bit. So, but we did it. I think in Spain, I co-produced it with my friend Paco Loco, and both records, I think they turned out great. And it was so devastating when Dallas passed away. It was just shocking. And every year that anniversary comes up, I think it's in February, it's just so sad. I know there's a new thing he did with Richard Perry. I forget the guy's name from Arcade Fire.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
They did a record together that came out recently. And but there's still talk. Once in a while, I stay in contact with
Travis.
Travis is like my good friend. What's his name? And there's been talk about doing another record together, but but it hasn't happened yet. But I'm so proud of them that they have continued on, and I've gotten up and played with them a few times and played Dallas's gear, his setup, and I was so honored. Once in a while I'll perform one of their songs.
I think they did find that mark, though. That one of the things I've always loved about them as a band is I love the songwriting, Thousand Cities Damned, tunes like that. But then you go see them. I think it's called A Thousand Cities Damned. Mm-hmm. Da, 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 rotten earth where a person's life is worth. How many people in possession? Right. Yeah, that one. And but then also, like you mentioned, they weren't above being showmen. When you would go to a Sadies show, there were like almost set pieces that they would come to at different parts of the show that would just bring down the house. And I miss that from bands these days to a certain degree. I love the showmanship aspect that they would bring to bear.
Yeah, they do that old country trick where one of them would get behind the other and do the fingering of the guitar while the other one. And that kind of just showman kind of stuff. Kind of old traditional country, because their dad and their uncles were part of the Good Brothers, and so they had a musical education growing up. But I think there's a song called what is it called, honey? The Sadie song I do.
Tell her what I said.
Yeah, and that's a good example of what I saw from the Sadies, which is unlike anything I've ever seen with any other band, was their writing process, because they didn't necessarily, I'm sure they did at some point, Dallas, but in general, they would sit down and they'd have this musical vocabulary that was without even talking. And they would write kind of, instead of having the melody and the words, sometimes they would just have the music that would kind of come together and they keep building it. Most people write it, they have a melody and a working lyric, and then you start playing around with the chords. They kind of did it the opposite, at least when I saw them. Sometimes Dallas would say, what do you think of this song? I'm like, I don't know what it is. It doesn't have a melody or words yet. I don't know. But Tell Her What I Said is like one of my favorite songs of all time by anybody. And they wrote it with a very collaborative with each other. But Dallas, especially, Travis was kind of mad picker and traditional, you know, a little bit more. I don't want to typecast them because they both did both things. But Dallas was the heavier, kind of a super, like carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders, and very deep. Knew a lot about gear and knew more than I did about, you know, tubes and echo units and everything, mixing boards. And he was just a big, heavy thinker. And, it was between the two of them, they were brilliant. But I know they're still making great music, which is...
They are indeed. Well, before I let you go, I do want to talk to you about this most recent record of yours, Dark Country. We've gone through and talked about all these different people.
The newest record is Sanctuary Park, which is the one that's coming out.
Please.
Dark Country is the solo. I love talking about that, too, but... No, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the album coming out.
Indeed. Please talk to me about Sanctuary Park then, because Dark Country, which I was just listening to earlier this week, was a solo affair, pretty much. I mean, you had Eleanor Whitmer was on it and a couple other people. But how does it contrast to this latest one that's coming out?
Well, I mean, it's a love. They're both, in a way, love letters to my wife, but Dark Country was definitely very personal love letter to my wife and a new life that I'd found and loved. It started off just me and a guitar, and I thought about getting a little combo and going to a studio. And as I waited around trying to figure out how I was going to do that, I just started playing the songs in my home studio. And I found that setting was appropriate for the songs. So just kind of over a course of time, I have, you know, some nice gear here, and I just made it at home. And even the cover was done by my wife and I, and she's on the cover and in our house. And, you know, like, we could, it's kind of a very homegrown kind of record. But this Sanctuary Park, which comes out August 28th, although there's two singles out now, was a true studio affair, you know. It was a full band and with a real producer. Not that I wasn't a real producer, but Bob Ezrin is a legend. And in a real legitimate studio with tape machines and like that.
Does it feel good after, you know, self-producing something like Dark Country? Does it feel like a weight off your shoulders to hand over the producer mantle to someone else? Someone else can make some damn decisions?
Yes. It's so nice to not have to run the show, because the last couple, you know, the last record, XOXO, and some of our other ones, I was basically the producer. And it's hard because you know, like on this record, I could just concentrate on the songwriting and the performing, because when you're a producer, it's not just twiddling knobs and placing mics. It's all about time management. What do we got to get done? Where are we at? How many more days do we have left? And it's like running a business project, you know? And also it's about keeping the other players up and involved and knowing how to speak to them, to encourage them or to criticize them. There's a lot of psychology involved. And to have somebody not only to take the reins, but somebody you trust is vital. So it was such a joy for me to be able to, because we could still contribute, of course.
Sure.
But just to have somebody, the go-to person who could help me sift through the songs, pick the right songs, pick the right takes, tempos, keys, sounds, and then to take it, and knowing it was in the hands of somebody who loved the project and would do the best for it was so comforting and thrilling at the same time.
Well, I'm glad it found good hands, and congrats on the impending release. We are so thankful for your time. Thank you so much for coming on The Working Songwriter, and let me know when you want to get that other podcast off the ground. I'll be happy to be a sounding board for that for you.
Okay, yeah. We already have a name. Okay. We have a theme. Now we just have to get it going. I have nice mics, and I have nice
there you go.
Gear. So I think once we get settled in our new place, maybe we'll start something.
There's nothing to it.
If I need your help, I'll get in contact.
There's nothing to it. You'll be fine. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Joe.
This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any new subscription. Gary Lurz's latest album is entitled Dark Country, available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.